Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
The individuals that use that data are livestock producers and meat industries, helping the ranchers, feedlot operators, and processors plan for their herd management, procurement, and prices based on cattle and supply trends.
Tori Joshua with USDA on expanding the July cattle report.
Market analysts and traders, they review and they look at that information, forecasting beef prices, supply trends as well. Policymakers and agribusinesses also utilize that data as well. And that's just July cattle. County estimates, corn, sorghum, and soybeans, county estimates. And that data is a reflection of where the crops is actually located in respect to not just corn, sorghum, and soybeans on May 6th. Cotton will be published on May 12th. Cattle will be published on May 13th. And finally, rice and peanuts will be published on May 23rd.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I would characterize things at the outset by saying that credit conditions in 2024 did in fact deteriorate slightly.
Nate Kaufman is with the Kansas City Federal Reserve. Speaking recently at USDA's Ag Outlook Forum on deteriorating credit conditions.
So there will be some caveats to this. Kerry mentioned a couple of them, which is to say some of the government payments that being distributed, it maybe hasn't fully hit some of the data that we would see in terms of some measures and how that might ultimately extend into credit. But I think fair to say that for about the past year or so, we've been seeing some of the deteriorating conditions. That said, agricultural real estate values did actually hold firm through all of 2024. This is something that we're watching quite closely. I'll talk more about that. There have been some signs of growing financial stress, and Kerry alluded to this in certain industries, and I'll try to show that a little bit more. But as I mentioned, some support here could, in fact, push some of this discussion into the future, and we'll see what next year's conference holds. But, we will spend time talking about how the market fundamentals will ultimately support credit throughout this year. I have one chart to start to talk very, very broadly at a high level on the U.S. economy before shifting into agriculture. And I feel like this is important context because agriculture is no different than other industries in that it's going to be dependent on what you see happening with respect to broader economic conditions, whether it's here in the U.S. or globally. If you've been following the discussion about inflation and some other things, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this slide, but what I want to point out would be the forecasts that were made in August of 2022. And the reason for choosing that forecast at that time period is because that's really when inflation hit its peak. Inflation peaked out, depending on which number you use, measure you use, about 7%. And there was an expectation going forward with the war in Ukraine, with anticipation that interest rates were going to need to rise to push back against inflation, that we would see economic growth slow down in the coming years, maybe even to something around half a percentage point. That's the forecast that was made in August of 2022. The reality is far different. We've actually experienced growth that's been on average of about 3% over the past 2 years, and so that's what's shown in that solid line. So I use this as a starting point to say that the broader economy has been supportive of economic activity. Real estate could be an example of that, but we could point to some other places. And agriculture has benefited to some extent from some of this momentum in the broader U.S. economy. With that said, though, it is worth pointing out some of the softness that we saw in agriculture in 2024. There are a number of measures I think that I could use, and I'll also offer my plug for USDA data. We rely pretty extensively when we're looking at things at the national level as well, in addition to some of our own data that we would capture when it relates to agricultural credit. There's a number of indicators that I could show to you to try to describe how things have evolved. I've chosen these four just to give you a very high-level measure, and the time periods that I chose for this chart are also quite important. So that period from 2010 to 2014, many of you will remember that these were exceptional years in agriculture. Farm profits were very high. Farm income was very high. We went through a subsequent 5 years just prior to the pandemic where that was not the case. Farm income was declining. There had been gradual increases in financial stress, and you can see that playing out in the rest of these indicators here. If you fast forward and look at the green bars, this was the state of agriculture from 2021 to 2023, arguably post-pandemic here for most of this. And then you can see what's happened in 2024 and now the forecast for 2025.
Nate Kaufman with the Kansas City Federal Reserve speaking recently at USDA's Ag Outlook Forum. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
It is absolutely, probably top of mind for the Fed, but they have no control for what spending is happening in Washington.
Josh Cannington is with StoneX.
Powell has said on numerous occasions that it's unsustainable. You know, we're spending money we don't have. And I don't know how Doge impacts that view from Powell at this point. It's yet to be seen. But I think the marketplace is very aware of the risk that the deficit has. And I'll give you this example. The first rate cut came in September. The 10-year Treasury only traded higher after that first rate cut, and it was directly related to the deficit, how much spending we were having. So it's one thing that the Fed pays attention to when setting floating rates, but it's the marketplace that really starts to reprice fixed rates with that risk out there.
What happens if that debt continues to increase?
Rates are going to be higher for longer, especially like fixed rates, like term debt. It's never going to get cheap again because the government's going to keep issuing treasuries, and who's going to be buying them? You know, the marketplace has a, you know, appetite for that stuff for so long. And if no one's buying that debt, investors are going to demand higher yields to buy it up. It's just going to be more and more expensive fixed rate debt out there. So I would say maybe in the short term, things like recessions drive rates lower. But generationally, I think rates are going to naturally creep higher simply because of the deficit.
We move from interest rates to CPI. That's the Consumer Price Index. Tyler Cousins with the Livestock Marketing Information Center.
CPI is kind of one of those gauges that we get once a month to kind of give us an indication as far as just overall inflationary measures that are going on, just for kind of those basket of goods that the consumers are purchasing there on a regular basis. So if we look at the all item CPI or Consumer Price Index for February, it was an increase of 2.8% compared to the same month a year ago. Now, if we look at this from the prior month in January of 2025, the change in January was actually an increase of 3%. So we've moved a slightly lower than we were from the prior month. You know, so this slight reduction, right, it kind of signals just some a little bit looser inflationary pressures. But we have to keep in mind that we're still kind of looking for that target inflationary rate of about 2%. So still a little bit of work there to be done, but definitely compared to where we were, even just a couple of years ago, we've definitely seen some vast improvement there as far as just some of those inflationary measures kind of working their way through the economy. And by and large, kind of getting back to closer to that 2% level, which is where we were kind of prior to 2020 and kind of that pandemic era there. So getting a little bit closer to that 2% inflationary measure is definitely a positive sign thing. You know, and one of those things when we look at the CPI, they actually have some other disaggregated components that they look at. And a couple of them I want to discuss here were the meat CPI, poultry CPI, and dairy CPI. So those kind of those measures that we can look at as far as what's going on in those kind of maybe more a little bit individualized components for the CPI. And then so specifically the meat CPI came in at an increase of 4% from last year. That's slightly higher than what we saw in the prior month of January of 3.8%. But I think, the gradual increase that we've seen in this meat CPI, we've seen this occurring for several months now, but still we're well below those double digit levels that we saw even just a couple of years ago in 2022. Poultry CPI, it was actually up 1% in February, which was the highest annual increase in about a year. But overall, it was still a small percentage change and in line with where measures have been over the last several months. Dairy CPI came in with an increase of less than 1%, actually 0.8%, which was in line with where their CPI has been for several months now. So kind of overall, some of this discussion on CPI, the measures indicate that inflationary prices have cooled somewhat to start the year, which is a positive sign for consumers.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
It's a pretty common question to ask, what is interest rate risk? It sounds like some economics textbook question to be asking yourself.
Josh Cannington is with StoneX.
But that's exactly what we do. We manage interest rate risk. And what it looks like for farmers is, you know, ask yourself the question, are operating lines going to get more expensive this year, cheaper, stay the same? You know, what market tools are out there to prevent them from going any higher? Are there ways to save money in this market? You know, where are rates trading today versus, you know, staying floating? And that's what we help farmers navigate and try to do.
So what does he do in this space?
So what we do is we aren't a bank. You know, we let you continue to have your banking relationships, but we give you access to risk tools that the marketplace has. So, for example, operating lines, you're borrowing floating. You know, tariffs are inflationary. You know, what happens with DOGE layoffs? You know, those tools change marketplace dynamics a lot. So, you know, the Fed has yet to cut again in 2025. So maybe they keep them here. Maybe they go higher if inflation comes back around. And what we do is help clients, you know, navigate that risk, that uncertainty. I'll give you a quick example. Like, fixed rates today in the marketplace are cheaper than floating. That's a pretty rare instance. You know, 9 times out of 10, fixed rates are more expensive than floating. And we have this weird dynamic where they're cheaper. So tapping into that resource has been really valuable for our ag clients.
So how are rates actually set?
It's a committee. It's called the Federal Open Market Committee, and Jerome Powell is the chairman. And what they do is they sit in a closed door room for 2 days. They talk about inflation. They talk about the labor market. But more importantly, what happens next? And at the current stance, the Fed is in this wait and see mode. You know, they don't know what tariffs are going to look like. They don't know what the economy is going to react to those tariffs a month or two from now. But the employment situation is pretty scary, too, because DOGE is actively laying off people. There's government freezes. And they're sort of stuck between this rock and a hard place. But that's how they're set. They're set by committee. They set the federal funds rate. And SOFR, which floating rate notes are based off of, is effectively the federal funds rate. So if the Fed is hiking rates, floating rates are getting more expensive. If the Fed is cutting rates, they're getting cheaper.
And what do producers need to know?
I wish we had a crystal ball to know what's next. And I would say that what you don't want to do is just cross your fingers and hope interest rates keep falling. Not doing anything is just as risky as taking an all-in position either way. So what we've seen a lot of people do is somewhere meet in the middle, where they try to get to a risk rate neutral stance, where half the debt's floating, half the debt's fixed. If rates go up, great, you have protection in place. If rates keep falling, great, half the debt keeps on floating down lower too. And that's what useful, like these market tools like swaps, options, that's where they become really powerful for farmers, where they can transform what the bank gives them and then transform it into something that works for them and what kind of a risk stance they want to take.
He also says, make sure you look at your debt.
From the top-down view of the organization, how much debt is fixed, how much debt is floating. Because what you're paying for your financing costs, that's an input cost like anything else. And if you're all fixed, well, you're not going to benefit if the Fed cuts. But if you're all floating, there's a lot of risk on the table that they keep hiking from here. So I think if you take a step back and see how much debt's fixed, how much is floating, what percentage is there, and then readjust and use the market tools to get you there. That's probably the best place to start.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So the Kansas City Fed represents 7 states in the middle of the country, which, as you can imagine, have a very high concentration in agriculture, both by way of production, but indirectly other industries that would be tied to it.
Nate Kaufman's with the Kansas City Federal Reserve at the recent USDA Ag Outlook Forum.
There's a couple of places specifically that I would highlight the importance. Jackson mentioned this in his pretext here, that agricultural is it's a capital intensive business. So we definitely understand the role that capital plays when it comes to ag. But the other I would say is that, and I'll describe my goal here in a second, as we go through the presentation, I would argue that what you see with respect to credit conditions can give you a pretty good picture of what's happening more broadly with respect to economic developments in the industry. So it's for a couple of those reasons. As I go through the presentation, my goal is so that many of you, if you don't spend a lot of time thinking about agricultural credit and what these trends look like, and maybe you come to a conference like this once a year, that hopefully it will give you a pretty good picture of what the trends have been and the kinds of things that we're watching in 2025. I know that's one of the things that I get a lot out of this conference is being able to see some other things that I don't follow as much on a regular basis.
He also focuses on farm loan repayment rates.
The one that I really want to call your attention to is the one that you see at the end there, and because partly it's my focus to talk about credit here today. And talking about farm loan repayment rate. So I'm going to be spending a fair amount of time talking about finance and measures of credit. This is a survey-based measure that we gather at the Federal Reserve, where lenders will describe for us the path as it relates to loan repayment that their farmers are experiencing in terms of their portfolios. And I think both the red bar and the gray bar are quite telling here, and that is to suggest that there have been some signs of financial stress. Anything less than the 100 line there means that it's essentially weaker than what it had been the year before. So there have been some signs of growing financial stress. It's something we've been watching quite carefully. There are some things here that I think you're going to see that look like they could be very similar to what we were experiencing, in fact, in 2018 and 2019 prior to the pandemic. One of the other things that we've been tracking here recently when we're thinking about gradual increases in financial stress is the pace of lending activity and demand for loans. It's typically the case in agriculture, not always, that farmers take often a fairly cautious approach with respect to debt. When incomes are quite strong, a lot of farmers will pay down some of their debt. They'll replenish working capital. They'll make sure that they have that liquidity for the next loan renewal season. And then the opposite tends to also be true. When they're in a more precarious financial position, that's typically when they demand more in the way of ag loans. So when you're looking at this chart, the first thing to notice, and was mentioned in the previous presentation related to input costs, is that dark blue line relating to operating expenses. We really haven't seen that pull back much. So when you're thinking about this from the perspective of a producer, expenses are still quite high. Commodity prices and income have been declining. That naturally leads into an expectation then that you're going to see more in the way of demand for financing. So if you look next then at that light blue line, that's what that would in fact show. That following a couple of years of softening demand for agricultural loans, we actually saw a bit of a rebound in 2024. Again, suggesting that farmers were in a position increasingly that they needed that financing. And similarly, as Kerry mentioned, the debt service ratio, after having shown some improvements, fell a bit, and you know we'll see what that looks like in 2025.
Nate Kaufman, Kansas City Federal Reserve. This is Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
If you think about electricity, the generation, the stack of how we generate electricity, you've got the base. Whether it's nuclear or hydro, depending on whatever region. You used to have quite a bit of coal. We know that's been going to the backside of that. And natural gas over the last 15 to 20 years has been the big component of generating electricity.
Dan Conrath covers energy for StoneX.
The renewable push over the past four presidents, not Trump 1.0, but you carve out that 4 years, was the renewable push into solar, wind, biodiesel, those types of markets. I think it's interesting. You can talk all you want about renewable growth, and in the end, renewable growth, I just saw a statistic from Bloomberg. I thought it was amazing that since 2010, we've had renewable growth, that would be total electric generation, about 0.6% per year from China. 0.6% from Europe, 0.4% from China, 0.3% from the U.S. It would take 20 more years for Europe to meet their renewable target, which they have by 2035, of 30% renewables. So, you know, the story of renewables is it moves slowly. It's very expensive. I think the mandate that maybe prior Trump administration had on the renewable side, it's definitely going to slow it down. But, you know, I've been in energy a long time, and renewables aren't going away. There's wind and there's solar, and that's good. The sun shines in a lot of places, and that's a good energy source. But the one problem with renewables when it comes to electricity, you can overbuild capacity. Solar is roughly 60%. There won't really be a lot more wind farms built, especially with the Trump administration. Two things President Trump says he hates is wind farms off the East Coast and solar farms on the West Coast. So you know he's going to battle everything over the next couple of years. As far as solar, the building of that, it's roughly going to be 70% of the future renewable growth over the next, let's say, 4 years until 2027. But when you talk about building renewables, you build a renewable facility on the solar side, the capacity of what you get out of that is maybe 25%. So you can build 2 gigawatts or 10 gigawatts and then carve that down by a fifth. It's going to take a long time. Fossil fuels, and I'm not an old fossil fuel guy, but fossil fuels are going to be around for a long time for one reason. They have to be.
And when we talk about renewables for electricity, what about nuclear?
You can look at Europe and you can see what's happened there. Germany stopped and basically was shutting down their nuclear units over the last 10 to 12 years. Look at their position now. They're in a deep, deep recession, and a big component of that is energy cost. At the same time they were reducing nuclear, they were also getting Russian cutoffs of energy going somewhere else. In the United States, the problem with nuclear, it's really a regulatory environment. And what Trump's doing, or the Trump administration is doing in the EPA, I think you'll see more nuclear growth. Japan's a great example. Was it Fukushima back in 2012 or something? And Japan basically shut down over the course of the next 10 years, five or six of their units, which they now have started to bring back. So nuclear is great, but from a cost standpoint, you've got a handful of builders out there. Who's gonna brunt the costs? And it's gonna be the public. It's gonna be us, and that's a hard sell.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
This program is kind of one of the first steps that USDA is making to kind of help producers kind of weather that storm that was the 2024 growing season and marketing year. So good to know that that's on its way.
Sean Wade with Plains Cotton Growers.
And then later in the year, we'll see, another round of assistance as the USDA finalizes all the details for the 2023 and 2024 disaster assistance packages that were also approved by Congress in December of last year. So a lot of good news coming through today with this first round of assistance, and then more to look forward to down the line as Congress works through those disaster programs as well. So the ECAP program is set to deliver approximately $10 billion in direct payments to producers. And then the disaster assistance programs that I mentioned a second ago would actually be bringing along another nearly $20 billion of assistance to growers to help offset, some of the tough times that the growers have been going through over the last couple of growing seasons, but most especially the economic situation that did impact so many during 2024.
Now, the sales closing date has already come and gone. Arkin PLC decisions next month.
It's been a very interesting period leading up to the insurance sales closing date. A lot of interest amongst growers. Of course, the last couple of years, producers have participated for the most part. When they bought the extra endorsements to kind of enhance their insurance coverages. For cotton, that has typically been a choice of stacks, like you said, the Stacked Income Protection Program. And that's mainly been because, for the most part, the FSA programs and where market prices were, those FSA programs were pretty far away from, the potential to trigger any payments. It's a little bit different situation now in 2024 going into 25. We see that the 2024 crop prices have come down and have kind of been kind of trading in a range that's very near the trigger points, especially for the PLC program for seed cotton. And so growers are, kind of looking ahead and saying, how do we protect against, maybe some further price erosion during 2025 and capture, any potential PLC payments that may come along. And in doing so, there's been a lot of interest, additional interest, in the supplemental coverage option and the enhanced coverage option, insurance endorsements instead of stacks. For seed cotton, a grower that participated in stacks is not eligible to participate in ARC or PLC over with the FSA programs. But if they choose the SCO or ECO options, they would have the ability to sign up and participate in PLC. For that 2025 growing season. So we've seen a lot of interest among growers in potentially switching over from stacks to SCO, ECO, or both, and then signing up for PLC to maintain that extra price protection that's offered through the FSA programs. So it's been a very, very eventful couple of weeks leading up to sales closing date, as growers have been really seeking out a lot of information about those two products that they don't normally take much of a look at just because of, just various mechanisms that made stacks a little bit more of an attractive option in the past. So I think we'll see a lot more SCO, ECO coverage in 2025 and a higher participation rate in PLC as well, from all indications.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The reinstatement of USDA reports is continued last year.
We heard from many individuals, organizations, farmers, as well as congressionals, that they wanted us to reinstate those programs.
With advanced budgeting, according to the National Agricultural Statistics Service's Troy Joshua, allowing for the reinstatement of the annual July cattle report.
July cattle will be published on July 25th.
And county estimate reports for crops and livestock. The county estimate reports start on
May 6th. We're going to be publishing corn, sorghum, and soybeans.
With additional county estimates for cotton, cattle, rice, and peanuts set for publishing in May as well. Joshua notes the importance of such reports in decision-making, whether on the producer or policy level, as well as the multitude of NAS reports and data sets found online at www.nas.usda.gov. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.